I'm going to start out this week by doing some talks on how to grow a lotus blossom, which I've been coming up to do for some time. I did a kind of introductory talk recently, if you remember. I'm going to start out by talking one more point that Remesser makes from her foreword, which is a very important point. Then I'm just going to go right into the substance of the text a bit. On page 27 of the foreword, which is in Roman numerals, Remesser says, "It is not always good to do deep meditation and training completely by oneself, as the reader will discover as he reads on. Nor is it wise to be in any place whatsoever where he can be much disturbed. The world is always anxious to push its way in when someone wishes to do something about himself. When advanced spiritual development is reached, the world seems to treble and quadruple its efforts to distract and dishearten. As the reader will soon find out, and it is then that faith in the memory of the first Kensho is absolutely vital. One second of doubt, even the possibility of thinking of the possibility of doubting, can cause the spirit to despair, and death is the result. True meditation is not for cowards. It is hazardous, perilous, and magnificent. For this reason, a place of absolute peace and quiet is necessary. You will also need a friend or a disciple who is perfectly willing to go to any lengths to keep the world from bothering you. I've received my fair share of criticism over many years now for the way I unashamedly defend this temple and have really put my own body, as it were, between this temple and the world, to try to keep the world out so that we have a place where we can peacefully train ourselves. And this paragraph that I've just read explains the reason why. When I was even a relatively young monk, I had the opportunity, I was drawn into and had the opportunity, initially under Remesser's direct guidance with her presence, to do very deep extended retreat. And I was just around 30 years old when I did my first one. It happened quite naturally, and it happened when I was with Reverend Master away from the monastery. And Reverend Master gave me immense amount of time and attention during that crucial period in my spiritual life. And I began to learn at that time just how vulnerable a person is when they really are drawn into truly deep meditation and the really deep cleansing and conversion of karma. It's like the layers, your kind of layers of your body and mind are peeled away, leaving something magnificent and something very kind of trembling in its vulnerability. This is so a really deep sangha can happen. I've often talked about the fact that the eternal eventually has to be able to take us apart and put us back together, and that's what it feels like at such a time. A person become incredibly weak. During that first period when I was in a very, very good physical condition, you know, within 24 hours, I was having to have someone help me to the bathroom. And that only lasted, you know, helped me walk to the bathroom, you know, not go in with me, but, you know, just support me to get there. And that depth of weakness passed very quickly, and I've never had that since, actually. Reverend Master in 1976 really was at the edge of death, and if she had not had people who were guarding her at that time, she would have died. You know, she's speaking from experience here. Because I had the opportunity to go through such experiences, and because I trusted what Reverend Master taught me about such things, it was very consciously my wish when this temple was being built that it could serve as a place for such retreats. And it has been very consciously on my mind for years that I, as abbot and as master of most of the people here, need to actively, you know, do what I can, and it's not perfect. I'm not saying that it is, but do what I can to hold worldly attitudes, worldly values, worldly ideology, worldly skepticism, especially worldly skepticism and doubt, and worldly frittering away at spiritual, the true spiritual life and true spiritual values, to hold them outside this temple as best I can. The result has been, you know, to me personally, very gratifying, that both I and other people have been able to do really wonderful retreats here in this place. And there's not a person that I'm talking to in this room who has not some way or other benefited personally from this fact. And what I want to tell you here, and what Reverend Master is trying to communicate, is that such circumstances for spiritual training are rare and not to be taken for granted. And not to be despised just because they're not the way everyone else does things. You know, we have to have the courage of our convictions. And we have to accept the consequences of the kind of limitations that we place upon ourselves and others in trying to have a place where the deepest training can take place, and where the Eternal can really get at us and really help us and really stop us in our tracks. Stop us in our tracks. Reverend Master couldn't give a stronger caution to people than in the passage that I just read. You know, she talks about the fact that the world seems to double its efforts to get at you and to prevent you from going deeper. And this is really true. I don't know why this is, but it is true. It doesn't mean that Reverend Master's paranoid. It doesn't mean I'm paranoid. You know, there isn't any us against them in this. There's just this fact. There's just this fact. When the Buddha found the middle path, began to find the middle path, and sat down in meditation, through meditation, gave up asceticism. During that period, some say it was one day, some say it was a week, who knows how long it actually was, during which he experienced his great enlightenment. You know, he was subjected to the attack of Mara. And the attack of Mara can take many forms. You know, the Buddha showed the way to deal with it from a position of faith and certainty and from the stillness of meditation. You don't go out and have a war with it. You know, you don't badmouth anyone or anything. You simply say no to what is delusory and go with your true heart. You say no to what is delusory and you go with your true heart. That's what he did that night or that week or that month or however long he was going through that. That's what he did. And everyone who follows in his footsteps is a beneficiary of that act that took place now 2,500 years ago. So who can calculate the merit of such a thing? And so are we the beneficiaries of our master's incredible courage and faith and certainty. And we're the beneficiaries of the faith and certainty of those who trusted her at this crucial time in her life that she's describing in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom. I won't be, you know, reading everything in between things that I talk about, but I really do strongly encourage people to read and reread and reread the section in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom entitled I Am Glad That I Became a Monk. This was written by River Master when she was just in the early stages of her retreat in 76. And this was like the teaching that was given to her to help her negotiate her way through the coming months, through all the difficulties. This is a name, rank, and serial number, as she used to say. This is the bottom line of teaching that she adhered to. The last two lines, or little verses, I'll just read here because this is the key thing. If I am to be a monk, I must unceasingly heed the Lord of the House. When the Lord of the House gives you his teaching, listen attentively and respectfully and quickly, loudly, reverently, and obediently say yes. Now, this shows, again, and this was written early on, this shows that right from the beginning, she was on it. She was following the Eternal, wherever the Eternal led her, and at whatever cost. And that was that. I'm now on page 2 here, the regular numerals. As I go deep into meditation, I see behind me a road in which can be seen many of the beguiling distractions of the world. At the end of this road is a great altar being served by 3 priests. I walk to the right of this altar and go round behind it where 2 roads appeared and a great mountain range. On the road to the left, there are more women than men, for their inadequacy is great, and they believe that they can get nowhere whatsoever unless a man helps them. Their world is a world of soap opera, of television, of gossip, of being enmeshed absolutely in their family life. There are some men upon this road, but women outnumber them 3-1. To the right is the road that leads to expensive entertainment, to high worldly success, to learning, to universities, to great places in the world of men, great names in politics and art. And on this road, men outnumber women 3-1. For they believe in their complacency that they are adequate, that all the best things are their prerogative. Yet they are trapped as much as are the women. The women believe they cannot move without a man because they are inadequate. And the men do not move because they believe they do not need to. Adequacy and inadequacy are equally dangerous traps. For both men and women, it becomes steadily more obvious that something is missing, something is needed. After all, where do these roads lead? Entertainments are an unreality, as are worldly success, money, fame, and fortune. All these things are but temporary placebos. When death comes, it has to be faced alone. The great entertainments, the great names, the great learning can do nothing then, any more than can the man in which a woman places her trust. He cannot save her at the hour of death. Behind me is what passes for religion. It tries to tell me how and why, but has no answers to my real questions. This is what I always think of as gray religion. Gray religion. It has no real answers. As Reverend Master says earlier in the very front of How to Grow the Lotus Blossom, that gray religion represented by the altar that she goes around in this vision, the altar that she goes around, that's a kind of worldly religion. She says, the true religious life takes those who essay it beyond isms, sects, and religious facades to that which brings total fulfillment. It is not until we are willing to go on beyond our greatest fears, which ordinary religions attempt to comfort and allay rather than teaching us to overcome them, that we are able to find truth. Thus, we have to be willing to go on beyond everything if we would be one with what the Buddha calls the unborn, undying, unchanging, uncreated. On page 3, Reverend Master goes on to say, "And yet these roads beckon me, and something in me says, choose one. You still have some time left. Enjoy it. There is nothing you can do." And another voice says, "Take no notice of those roads. Know that nothing really matters. Be mindful." I am in terror, but I heed the latter voice. Something vaguely remembered from the Kensho in 1962 bids me go on. Am I imagining this? Do not doubt that Kensho. It did happen. Go on. So refusing to go down either road, either the road of adequacy, worldly adequacy, or the road of worldly inadequacy, I see nothing but the great mountain range before me. Over these mountains, heavy storms rage. The mountain faces are sheer like glass. How can they be scaled by a being who has no knowledge of how to climb, no rope, no means of grasping the glassy surface? This is the situation of someone confronted by the emptiness and meaninglessness of worldly paths. Someone who has the inner certainty, there is that that which lies beyond the opposites. There is that which is our true refuge, and whose body and mind are filled with the fear that comes up at this time. Her master didn't pretend, "Oh, I'm this great Zen master, I'm not afraid." She says, "I'm in terror." Yet still, even within that fear, she listens to this quiet voice. And what she's faced with in that sheer, glassy mountain ahead of her, with the storms raging above it, that's a place you have to go through pure faith. Pure faith. Let go of the externals. Let your body and mind be saturated with the fear. It doesn't matter. Just keep taking a step, one step in faith after another. So all of us, have our own versions of this experience that we either have come to in our life or that we will come to one day. None of us is going to be spared this. And at that time, we are responsible for what we listen to, for which of the voices we listen to. We're responsible for that. We all possess the Buddha nature. We all have some mucky, confused karma. Which are we going to listen to? She's describing with perfect honesty someone who's had a kensho, who's had experience of the eternal, who's been training herself ever since that experience, and now who is facing the very real possibility of her own death, but more importantly, is facing simply the end of the road of worldliness. Come to the point where the world has nothing to offer you, what do you do? Do you turn back to what you know is empty and meaningless? Or do you go on? The first part of how to grow a lotus blossom is how to go on. The first chapters of How to Grow a Lotus Blossom is showing how to go on if you choose to go on. She's not saying how anyone else should go. She's not giving any thou shalt or thou shalt not. She's just showing how she went. And those of us who had the privilege of being around her, benefiting from her teaching and her help during that period, I at least will never forget the magnificence of what she showed us. How to go on in pure faith. How to go on in pure faith. How to enter the porthole. The portal. How to enter the doorway of deep meditation. And how to proceed in faith. We are all the beneficiaries of the magnificence of this human being's spiritual life. I was saying privately to a couple people here the other evening that, and I still, I mean, I will go to my deathbed thinking this. I cannot believe the good fortune that I have had to be the disciple of this person who showed the way so clearly and who is such a magnificent human being. You know, the only thing that greatness really means, ultimately, is this kind of spiritual greatness that she showed. And that she believed, and I believe, we're all capable of. It's not just one human being's prerogative. It's not just Shakyamuni Buddha or Dogen or Keizan or Mansan or Ko Zenji or Master. She saw this potential in all of us and always believed in it. And it's really the duty of all of us who would follow in her footsteps. Maybe duty is a bad word. It is a bad word, really. The privilege, really, of all of us to believe in that in ourselves, that we also have the capacity to do this, that we have that capacity for pure faith, you know, simple childlike trust in the eternal. And we have the capacity to be that honest with ourselves. To do as Dogen said, to see where we are and where we are not. And from the where we are not side, to cry out for help to the eternal. You know, please show me the way. Please help me. Follow the path of truth. In this great experience that River Master really learned how to ask at the deepest level, really learned how to listen at the deepest level, really learned how to follow at the deepest level. That it's not till we're really truly on hands and knees that we truly know the need, the extent of our need. It's not until we are crying out from our heart out of that need that we truly know the place the eternal has in our lives. The fact that the eternal is all of our lives.